Okay, Erev Tov, we're very quickly getting to the end of the Sefer. We've got another two prakim. Page 85 in the blue book, Perek Chaf Gimel. And before we start, I'm just going to make a dedication this week. And on the 5th of Nisan is the yahrzeit of Nechama Leibovitz, Zichron Livracha. She died in 1997. And there's a lot of stories. I gave a talk here about her, which is online, and you can hear some of the Maiselech and all the incredible stories. And for every one that I have, there's probably a dozen out there for other people, and it's just endless. I think my favorite is probably the story she told. What she did is that she used to do, like teaching Novi like this, she would do questions. And she did dapim, she did pages, which she sent out. And she started doing this during Second World War II. So at the bottom of the daf, it says that please return to En Leibovitz, Kiryat Moshe, Jerusalem. And he used to get to her, right? That was the address. They did have to put a building. Everybody knew where Nechama Leibovitz was living. Good evening. But what is cute is that she mentioned once that she got a paper back from El Alamein, from the front line. There were two soldiers there from the Jewish Brigade who were fighting the Germans, and they in between battles, they had nothing to do. So they learned Novi. So they're in Egypt. Where else? What better place probably apart from Israel to actually learn about this stuff? And she said that she got the pages, and the reason why she knew where it was coming from, because it was covered in sand. And she said there was obviously they were in the desert somewhere, because otherwise it wouldn't have been so sandy, the whole thing. And, you know, how the mail got from El Alamein to Jerusalem, that seems to be a bit of a miracle. But that was one of her favorite stories about how, you know, you never know where people are learning, where people are sitting, and, you know, being able to study. So, a remarkable woman. She passed away in 1997, and I mentioned in the talk that I gave a few years ago that I went to the graveside, must have been about 10 or 11 years ago. She's buried in Har Menuchot, just really where you come in, one of the major entrances there. I suppose it's what is called Chelkat Rabbanim, but you know, she's also got a place over there with some of the big rabbis. And she was such an awesome woman, so sort of frightening that I expected her, as I'm standing there saying a Tehillim, that she would sort of stick her hand up out of the grave and say, get out of here, go and learn. Because she wouldn't have time for this. She had no time for people being sentimental and sort of being kind of, you know, this type of religiosity, she just didn't want to know. She was into study and Torah study, and she was a remarkable woman. So there's a lot to say, but to her yahrzeit is the 5th of Nisan. May her memory be for a blessing. We're looking at Perek Chaf Gimel, and we're going to actually look a bit also in Chaf Gimel, a bit into Chaf Dalet, 23 and 24, page 85 in the blue book. And what happens here in the last two chapters of Sefer Yehoshua is kind of something interesting that in the end, of course, we go back to our original point. The original point was how much of Moshe Rabbeinu is copied by Yehoshua, how much is he a continuation of what Moshe was about, and how much is, in fact, Yehoshua different to Moshe Rabbeinu. This is one of the great focuses of the Sefer, of the book. As we go through it, some things we find Yehoshua is very much in the same mold as Moshe Rabbeinu, and in other things he's actually quite different. You know, we pointed that out already sort of a number of times. And at the end of Yehoshua's life, we're going to get the similar comparison all over again. He is coming to the end of his life. He knows that he's going to die very soon. And he has to bid farewell. He has to say goodbye to Am Yisrael. All right, so what did Moshe Rabbeinu do? Vayelech Moshe, you know, we know the parsha. Moshe goes around the whole of the Jewish people to say goodbye, and he gives the famous brachot, Zot ha-bracha she-berach Moshe lifnei moto. This is the blessing of Moshe before he died, and he goes to all the tribes, he speaks to everyone individually. Yehoshua doesn't do that. Yehoshua does a more package deal. He tries to get everybody together. And you'll see in chapter 23, he directs his comments initially to the leadership. I think Yehoshua maybe thought about it and said, look, I'm not Moshe Rabbeinu. I'm not going to be giving this long drasha that Moshe gives, you know, for how many weeks? It says like almost 40 days, something like that he gave to the whole of the Jewish people. On and on and on. Moshe spoke. Yeshua says, no, I can't do that. That was my Rebbe and that's not me. But what I am going to do is try and give chizuk, to give some sort of encouragement to the leadership. And we'll see what happens when the leadership listens to the encouragement of Yeshua. Remember, this is now further down the line. They've been fighting for 14 years. They are now at peace for another 14 years. We spoke about that. It's been 28 years that Yeshua has been running the show. And in 28 years, things have settled down. They haven't quite conquered the whole of Israel. There are still areas which will need to be conquered. That's the beginning of Sefer Shoftim. Yehuda Ya'aleh says, who's going to lead once Yeshua is gone? And they start looking for leadership, and there's no obvious leader, so they start leading by tribes. Yehuda will lead, and they follow Yehuda into battle, and that's the beginning of Sefer Shoftim. But what is fascinating is that you will see, chapter 23, Yeshua says goodbye to the leadership of the Jewish people. And then in chapter 24, he says goodbye again. It's strange. He does the farewell thing, the exit stage left that he does it twice. And this is really the biggest question that we have to deal with in terms of Yeshua's final finale, as it were, to the Jewish people. Why does he leave them twice? Okay, that's the famous question, that's the fundamental question, and we'll see, we may get a bit of an answer already today, and this is something that will carry us through till next week. What is also very exciting for next week, I may not do it in detail, we may just see the psukim today, is that part of the Haggadah of Pesach, you may be surprised, actually comes from Yeshua chapter 24. Okay, something that we may not have realized, and we'll see verbatim where those psukim come from, we'll talk a bit about those psukim as well. So, have a look at page 85. And it's chapter 23. And when we're done with the chapter, as I said, we'll look at maybe just a few psukim of chapter 24. I've just got a page to give you, which will look at some of the sort of nuances of what we've been learning. So have a look at this. Chapter 23. Vayhi mi yomi rabim. It's been many days, and it doesn't say how long. So we know that the Chazal tell us that it's been 28 years. All right, or rather, it's been 14 years fighting, and now another 14 years, which is called Yomim Rabbim, many days. That God has given them rest from all the enemies, so they've been at peace for 14 years. Yeshua zokein ba bayomim. Yeshua is now old ba bayomim, an expression which we understand means come. He's brought days with him. He's aged. The Babi Yamim, I once heard a pshat, and I might have said this before, because it says it with Avraham Avinu, says it with David, I think I'm not mistaken, and it says it with Yeshua. And it may say it with others as well. So it seems like a double expression. Zakein, Babi Yamim. If he's old, he's old. But Babi Yamim means the following. There's a story. And the story I remember from yeshiva days that they spoke about Reb Elia Lopian, one of the very great musaniks of the pre-war generation who came to London in the 1920s and went after he'd been in London for 30 years in charge of the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva in London. He then went to Eretz Yisrael when he was 70 in his 70s to start a new career at that stage of the game in Kfar Hasidim in the north of Israel. And he was there till he died in 1970. Remarkable man. And he had a little book in his vest. In England called a waistcoat, right? In his vest. And this little book was his diary. And nobody knew what was in there. And when he died, the story came out. And the story came out that every day he would write down anything and everything that he did which was not connected to learning. Because he wanted to keep a track of the time that he didn't spend studying. All right, and this was a tradition from Lithuania, and I think they say in the name of the Vonnegut that maybe the Vonnegut did this. And they found this little book, this like small diary, with kind of what they call in Hebrew, kishkushim, you know, these little squiggles, marks, right? Day by day. And it was literally a few minutes every day that he didn't study. It's remarkable. And this is what the rabbis explain over here, zakein babi yamim. Zakein means he was old, but babi yamim means that every day he could account for what he did. He did not waste one day of his life. It's remarkable. And this is the babi yamim. He could come before God at the end of his life and bring all of his days with him to show God that every single day had something positive, that something was done, that he managed to grow spiritually every single day of his life. This is something very unique. And that's why the expression is not used very often. But I remember hearing this pshat many years ago. Don't remember now from where, but probably from Rav Salomon when I was in my younger days. Anyway, so that's what it says over here. Pasuk Bet. Vayikra Yoshua lechol Yisrael, lezakeinav, lerashav, leshoftav, leshotrav. Now he's calling to Israel, but who is he calling? Zakeinim, the Roshim, the elders, the heads, the shoftim, the judges, and the shotrav, and the shotrim. Okay, not mishtara in the sense like today, the police, but shotrim, like the people who were officers, right? They were the enforcers. But Yomer Aleim Aniza Kanti Bati Beyamim, and he says, I'm now getting to the stage where I know I'm going to die. And again, look back. I can't go through it now, but there's a fantastic Orach Chaim HaKadosh, unbelievable comment that he makes that on Moshe Rabbeinu. How did Moshe Rabbeinu know that he was going to die? You know, how do these tzaddikim know that the time is coming? How do they know this? You know, obviously, if you're ill and you're dying, you know, the doctor will know. But these are people who literally are still hale and hearty. You know, like Moshe Rabbeinu, lo nos lecho, you know, rucho, etc. It says his spirit was strong. And here also, Yeshua is prepared to stand up and give a speech. He's 110 years old. So he's not a yingle by any means. He's not a youngster over here. And nevertheless, he knew that this was it. The time had come. And the Orach Chaim talks about some sort of, again, says with tzaddikim, there is a very sort of intimate spiritual connection to God, and they feel that that connection is beginning to, you know, sort of disconnect. And that they feel this, they know this in their neshamas. So he explains it, and if you want to look at it there, in Parsha Vayelech, it's very interesting reading. Orach Chaim, the Orach Chaim was 47 years old when he died. Unbelievable. 47. Reb Chaim ben Attar. You go to Israel today, into Jerusalem, they actually have recreated his house. In the Jewish quarter, there's Rechov Orach Chaim, and in that street there is a recreation of his how he lived. He lived in Jerusalem 300 years ago. It's fascinating. So they've recreated his whole living quarters, his whole lifestyle. Right? And he was 47 when he died. He came from, I think, from Morocco, or he came from North Africa. I don't remember where he came from. Unbelievable. You know, what people have achieved in very short time. It's incredible. All right, Gimel. So now he gives his speech. You have seen. And again, remember, he's not talking to the whole nation. He's talking to the elders. He's talking to the leaders. And he gives them the following chizuk. And listen to this speech. Look what God has done to all the nations around you. That God fights for you. Right? God is on your side. Ru'u, see. Right, and again, he's appealing to their sense of awareness, right? That they've seen this, they've experienced this. This is this is the answer that the Kuzari gives when the Ten Commandments begin. I'm the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt, and the question is asked: why doesn't it say, "I'm the Lord your God who created heaven and earth"? Right? If God is introducing himself to the world, you know, tell us about your PhD. Don't tell us about your lower degree. Taking out of Egypt compared to creating the world was very minor. The answer is no. Taking out of Egypt was something that people saw. If they saw it, they experienced it, then they feel very close to God. It's when you talk about the heavens and the universe, we can't relate to that. That's just too far away from us. So this is the idea. Ru'u, see and understand and take into your heart what you did see, what you will see. Ru'u hipalti, verse 4, Dalit. Ru'u hipalti lachem et ha-goyim ha-nishrim ha-ele b'nachal l'shivtechem. Look what I did. I have now divided up from the nations who are nishrim ha-ele, those who are remaining, in inheritance for your tribes. In other words, we have now gone through the land, and we've divided up all the different sections of the land to each tribe, even though we mentioned this before, that not all the land was yet conquered, but they have already know that even the bits that are not conquered, they know when they conquer them, who is going to live there, which tribe is going to be there. Mina Yardain from the Jordan, obviously going from that side, v'cholagoyim asher hikhrati v'ayam ha-gadom v'vo ha-shemesh, and all the nations that I have cut off, all the nations that we've conquered, and going to the Yam HaGadol, to the Mediterranean, in other words, from sea to shining sea. Not quite the similar concept as it is here, not quite as far, a couple of miles. All right, from the Yardin to the Mediterranean, I don't know, what is it? 25 miles, 30 miles, I mean, it's not very much. Quite shocking if you think about it, but there you go. And that's the whole size of Israel. So he's saying that has all been conquered. Or is in the process of certainly not necessarily conquered, it's all been divided up. Listen to this. Hey, V'Hashem Elokeichem Hu Yedafeh Mipneichem. Then again, stressing the fact that God is with you. He has pushed these people away. V'Horish Otam Lifneichem, and He has driven them out. V'Yerishtem Et Artsam Kasher Dibar Hashem Elokeichem Lachem, and you've inherited their land as Hashem, your God, has spoken to you. Fine. V'Chazaktem Ma'od. This is His byword. This is Chazak Ve'Emats, back to chapter 1, right? Four times over there. V'chazak te'emot, be very strong, be resolute. V'shmor v'lasad ekol ha'katuv v'sefer Torah Moshe, keep all the laws in the book of the Torah of Moshe. Levil tisur mimenu yom v'nesmol, quoting the Torah itself, don't go to the right, don't go to the left, but you have to follow the path, you have to follow the derech, right? And again, he goes on, Zayin, levil tibo b'goyim ha'ela nisharim ha'ela itchem, not to come amongst the nations. This is one of his big issues. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. That he's worried about the fact that once they settle in, once they become a bit, how should we say, apathetic, a bit complacent, the next thing you have is, you know, you become pally-pally with the people around you, become buddies. And that's going to be a problem because they are coming from such a different culture and they're coming from such a different world that it won't be that you'll influence them, it'll be that they will influence you. And this becomes a big feature at the beginning of Sefer Shoftim. But he warns them. He says, don't come amongst those nations, ubishem Eloheim lo tazkir, don't mention their gods, velo tashbir, don't make promises or oaths in their name, velo tavdum, velo tachvalem, don't serve them, don't bow down to them, keep away from their religion because it is very enticing. And he admits it, chet. Ki im b'Hashem Elokeichem tidbaku, you should cleave to God. Again, quoting from the Torah, kasher asitem hayom hazeh, you have done until this very day. And he goes on, and he's stressing he's giving a more religious speech. There's no question about it. His drosha is not about the history of conquering the land. This is about looking at it from a higher level. Who has helped us to conquer the land? Who will continue to help us to conquer the land? We've got to put our trust, our faith. We've got to make sure everybody understands it's all in the hands of God. And Tet, Vayorish Hashem Mibnechem, Goyim Gedolim Atzim, God has driven out even greater and more mighty nations. Be'atem lo amad ish bifnechem ad yom hazeh, nobody stood before you to this very day. Not quite true. If you remember, there were one or two hiccups along the way, but essentially, you know, we've walked in, we've gone right across the country, and we have conquered more or less everything. Yud. Ish echa mikem yudof elef, and this again, referring back to the Torah. We had a promise that one person will chase 1,000. And this has been fulfilled. Ki Hashem Elokeichem Elokam Lachem Kasher Dibar Lachem, because God is fighting on your side. All the time, the same message. Yudala, v'nish maratem elonav shoseichem, la'avas Hashem Elokeichem. And he is aiming so high. He says, be careful to love Hashem. Right? Again, allusions to the Shema, you know, this is replete with all the language that we would expect. You'd bet ki im shov tashum, because what happens if you turn away? Udavakta miyeta goyim ha'ele, and you become close to these nations, and anisharim ha'ele itchem, who are with you, v'isnach v'hit chatantem b'hem, you'll become connected through marriage. Ubotem b'hem ve'im b'chem, you will go amongst them, they will come amongst you, and there's going to be a problem. And it's so interesting in Sefer Shoftim, and if you listen online, to go back to those shurim that now 6 years ago, when we started learning this in Sefer Shoftim, the whole issue there is that they do start intermarrying. But they don't intermarry. What they do is that they convert the non-Jews around them so that the Chatan and Kala are basically both recognized Jewish, but of course they haven't converted the parents. So for instance, if it's a nice Jewish girl marrying this boy from the nations around, he's converted. But what happened to his family? His family is still of the Amorites or whatever other nation it is. And it's explained over there that even though the young couple may be recognized as a Jewish couple, but the parents get together, family occasions, whatever it may be, the Seder night, you know, they want to come and see what a Jewish Seder is about. If we come to you, why don't you come to one of our pagan festivals? And before you look around, there is an interaction between the non-Jews and the Jews, and it works detrimentally on the Jewish community. It's fascinating. And this again is one of those big question marks even today, the whole question of civil marriage in Israel and, you know, sort of all the standards which are established, certainly standards of marriage and divorce are lefi halacha. There are very famous examples of people who dafka went out of their way to not be lefi halacha. They usually went to Cyprus and got married there. There's a famous judge of the Supreme Court, Chaim Cohen, wanted to marry a divorcee. Right? Now he's a Cohen. What's he going to do? So he disappeared off to Cyprus and married her. This is a long time ago. He was a very very aggressive man against the religion. It's very difficult. It's very tough. It's not easy to population to deal with when people are sort of feel they're being coerced. And there's a lot to say about that. But this is going back in history. The problem of the influence, the outside influence. And Yeshua is laying it on the line. But listen to this, you Gimel. You'll know that God won't continue to drive out these nations if you do not follow the rules of God. And then they'll become a stumbling block. They'll become like an obstacle. They'll be like a thorn in your side, and like something in your eyes, thorns in your eyes, and a goad is a shotet, whatever that is, or something which will make a hole in you. Till you be destroyed from this land. Again, this is all second paragraph of the Shema. Asher natan lachem, Hashem elokeichem, which God has given you. V'hine anochi olech hayom. He says, I am now going to leave you. But derech kol ha'aretz, I'm going in the way of the whole world. I'm going to die. V'yedatem b'chol levavachem b'chol nashachem. He is laying it on the line. Wow. You know, he's into Shema in a big way. You should know with all your heart and with all your soul, nothing of the good things has fallen away. What are the good things? Which God has spoken to you. Everything has happened. Nothing has failed. Everything that God promised has been delivered. When every good thing comes upon you, which God has spoken to you, you should know if the good things have happened, then it's going to be also, if you don't follow the script, the bad things can happen as well. This is the classic argument. Arish mido otchem, until you'll be destroyed, me'al adama tova azot, from this good land, shenatan lachem Hashem elokeichem, which God has given you, but avrachem et brit Hashem elokeichem, if you go against the covenant, remember we spoke about various covenants that Yeshua sort of made with the people, and even last week we spoke about this fact that when they went home, the 2.5 tribes, there was some sort of a connection that was still made, a promise, promises were made and to be fulfilled in the future, etc., not to lose contact. And he says, if you don't do that, verse 16, Ted Zion, but Avrachem et Brit Hashem Elokecha, you go against the covenant of Hashem, Asher Tzivah, Etachem, which he commanded you, v'alachtem, you will go, v'avadatem lehem acherem, and serve other gods, v'shtachavitem lehem, and bow down to them. It's like the Shema. V'charaf Hashem b'chem, God's anger will be kindled against you, v'avadatem meherem alot satov asher natan lachem, and you'll be destroyed from the land. Now, it's so interesting. He's given this phenomenal speech. Now, you know, at the end of the drosha, you know, the rabbis always joke about this. How loud is the Yasher Koach at the end of the drosha? All right? If it's a big Yasher Koach, then you know that people sort of enjoyed this. If it's a kind of feeble Yasher Koach, then you know most of them were sleeping. And if there's no Yasher Koach, then, you know, maybe time to look for another job. It's one of those sort of guidelines. It's not really a guideline. But at this point in time, we're waiting for the Yasher Koach. We're waiting for the leaders to say something. And what happened? The end of chapter 23, nothing. Silence. The silence is deafening over here. Because look what he does in the beginning of chapter 24, Chaf Dalet. V'yesov Yeshua et kol shivtei Yisrael shechema. He decides to gather everybody. He tried the leadership. The leadership said nothing. They heard it and there was no response. Yeah.
He was going to get a response. That's why he called them back again. When he realized the leadership might be after him, because Chazal didn't like him.
Yeah.
That's why the people are not Hazal.
Yeah.
The people, that's why he's calling back everybody.
And he's calling everybody. And
he will get a response.
I will add to this that again, you know, if you take the rabbinic traditions, particularly married Racha, I can't believe for one minute that everybody was overly excited about the fact that he'd married this woman, you know, even with all of her credentials. I just feel that that might have been one of the issues that they had with him. It turns out, again, we learned this at the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, that when he died, they didn't make hespedim for him. They did not do the hespedim that they should have done, no eulogies. And this was a big problem, because here you've got the leader of the Jewish people, and you know, you've got to recognize his contribution, everything that he did, everything he gave, his life for Am Yisrael, and nothing. And it says that he is buried, it says at the end of chapter 24, which we're not going to read today, we'll do it next week, but he's buried in a place called Har Gash. Har Gash doesn't exist. The rabbis say, where is Har Gash? Gash means volcano. And it says what happened was, the day that he was buried, and there was no hespedim, it said the land began to earthquake. There was like a volcano going on. Because it was so unacceptable that there was like, you know, it was a reaction from God against Am Yisrael. You can't leave this man just to bury him and then move on and do nothing to recognize his contribution to Jewish life. It's impossible. And they did, and they left it. And he wasn't buried with the Jew circumstance that he deserved. And the land reacted. It's very interesting. A lot of midrashic material about that. So you've got to be careful when a gadol, when a great man dies, the respect that one has to give him. Yeah.
Why would they do that? Was there such an animosity?
It's very odd. It's hard to explain, but they seem to have felt, you know, it could be that they felt that he had, for instance, one of the things we spoke about, he dragged out the war. All right, he could have finished the war much, much quicker. But it seems to have gone on and on and on. There's an extra 7 years. First, they conquered the south in 3 months. They conquered the north, it took 7 years. So there might have been resentment about that. I mean, there's certain resentments that people can have against the leadership, which may not be expressed by the people, but is reflected at, you know, when the person dies. And it's so interesting. I'll never forget the Levi in Israel. I know there was a big Levi here when Ramosha Feinstein died. All right, now who's this guy? Again, you know, someone that the vast majority of people, there were over 200,000 people they estimate that came out. I've got a picture at home of it. From the Ma'ariv newspaper, and you were here on the Lower East Side, because I saw the pictures of that as well. I was, because it was on Shushan Purim in Israel, and it was unforgettable. And there's a very spooky story which I tell only because my brother-in-law assures me that it's true, because it's in the Artscroll book, and a lot of those stories in the Artscroll book are not true. There's a problem with that book, but this story apparently was true. There was a guy who came back from the Leviathan after Ramosha died, and there was all these hundreds of thousands of people. And he went home to his wife, and he had a little complaint. And he said, you know, it's been an amazing experience, obviously, to be in such a thing, but what happened to Purim? You know, Shushan Purim in Israel and Yerushalayim is Purim. And it kind of spoiled the whole day. And it turned out what happened was that he started getting headaches. Like after about a week or two, he started getting very bad headaches. And this went on, all right? It's in the article. If you've read it, you'll know the story. And it went on and on. He went to see doctors and specialists and he was getting desperate. And as in the course of discussion, he spoke with another Rav who, you know, he went to for Shilas or whatever. And he told him he's not feeling so good. And the Rav said, when did it start? So he said, pretty soon after the Levaya, when Ramosha died. And he said, and the Rav asked him a very, very direct question. He said, did you say anything bad about Ramosha Feinstein? So he said, well, you know, I just, when I got home, I maybe said to my wife that, you know, Purim had been spoiled a bit because of the Levaya. He says, you've got to take 10 Jews, you've got to go to the graveside of Ramosha and ask him for mechila. Unbelievable story. And this guy did it. He took 10 people, went to the graveside, asked for mechila, because it was a derogatory thing that he said. And of course, the story concludes, his headaches went away. You know, that's the end of the story. But it's kind of a scary story, right? And this is, you're dealing with someone that, like, you know, you saw him on a daily basis, you know. And we've got to be so careful sometimes of the people that we take for granted in a way. All right? And yet, you know, when it comes to a certain point, like, for instance, in terms of Hesped, if a person dies, you've got to give them the due respect. And it's not for them. They're gone. I mean, you know, all right, maybe spiritually they will appreciate it if we can understand it that way, but it's for us. It shows that we have understood, number one, what that person contributed while we were here, and more to the point, what we've lost now that he's gone. And that's Misa Tzadikim. It's really a very special thing.
The truth of that story is deeper. You've got to take that story and say,
yeah,
not only did he not have room for,
yeah,
he made it even more appreciative. And that's what the story doesn't
tell. That's what the story probably should say.
He ruined it because he can't be that happy. But since the Hesped of the Tzadik will bring you spiritually closer, he made it even greater.
It made it even greater, yeah. There is this strange picture I have at home of people going to Levi, all dressed up, you know, the chassidim are dressed in their Shabbos gear, all right, all wearing strimals, and they're going to this Levi. It's like the strangest photo. And in the middle, there's a guy with a kippah sruga, with a white kippah, right in the middle of the whole thing. Right, really, it's a very, very dramatic picture that that the newspaper put out the day after. So that's the problem with Yehoshua. It doesn't happen, and one can speculate what the issue was. You know, what they didn't like. There may be some things there. And of course, you know, it reminds you of Mordechai. What happens at the end? He gives his life and soul for the Jewish people. He's sitting, praying and fasting and all the rest of it for weeks and months, for years probably, till the whole story ends. And then what happens at the end? Ratzui l'rovecha. All right, he's only acceptable to the majority of the brothers, not to everybody. People still had complaints. Too close to the king, too close to this, too that, too... Who knows? You know, Jewish leadership is always very, very... Well, the population is very critical of the leadership. And this is not a new thing. And Mordechai suffered from it. And I think Yehoshua also gets a pretty raw deal. Just have a look again. As I said, we'll just look at one or two psukim in Chof Dalet. Ve'yesov Yehoshua et kol shivtei Yisrael shechema. And there's a question that I'm going to not answer this week, but he goes to Shechem. Why doesn't he go to the Mishkan? The Mishkan is in Shiloh, all right? But he takes everybody to Shechem. I'll leave that question for something to think about, because this is the meeting number two. He brings all the people together in Shechem. Vayikra lezikne Yisrael, he calls to the elders, l'rashar, to the head, shoftav, shotrav, yidyatzu lifnei holikim. And they stand before God. This is Atem Nitzavim Hayom. The only thing is interesting for the person who's the Balkara, or whoever can remember the Posuk there, Atem Nitzavim Hayom Lifnei Hashem Lekeichem, right? What does he start off with? He starts off, sorry, what's the first one? Rosh Eichem Shivtechem. Look what he does over here. Vayikra Lezikne Yisrael Arashav. Switch. He starts with the Zakenim and then the Rosh. And of course, the question is, why does he switch it around? If Moshe Rabbeinu started with the heads of the tribes and the Zakenim, why does Yehoshua call to the Zakenim and then to the heads? He switched it around for Moshe Rabbeinu, which is clearly a difference. As we said, a lot of this is continuation from Moshe, but there are nuances of difference. And that's what I want to give you this page. I want you to see something very fascinating. I just want to pass these around. We're looking at the second page, we're not looking at the first page. The first page is more about something I just mentioned, the whole idea of the two meetings, which we'll talk a bit about next time. But look at the second page, it's C, page 2 that you have, the second page, the one that's the second page of that's stapled to the... I tried to do a double, but my machine wasn't working, I had to do two pages.
Can I just mention something about the...
Yeah,
like
yeah.
And when I'm thinking about everything is start getting connected together.
Yeah.
When in the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua, you know, Hashem give the Yeshua the authority, and he tell him Chazak ve'ematz, just Chazak ve'ematz.
Yeah.
You know, take authority.
Thank you.
Take authority, whatever.
Yeah.
And now also like I feel like you know, the old nation, the old mainland never accepted his leadership,
yeah,
for the 100%.
Yeah,
and if we can take like a little sample in the end now, when we just read about it like last week, you know, when there's going to be like a civil war in between the there,
which is
and
incredible.
What you're doing,
yeah,
is sitting inside,
and then he's
not,
he's not there.
You want to go find them? Go
yeah.
Go
yeah,
them.
Yeah, and he's you know, not there.
I cannot imagine that it's going to be in Moshe's thing. Somebody come.
Yeah, Moshe's not going to sit around.
Yeah. I think he took like a passive role, like
yeah.
More like a messenger than leader.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Maybe it's everybody.
It's always that
buying the same way.
It's so interesting. Yeah, what you're, I mean, there is a thing. I'm trying to think of a good example in the modern day where you have people who are always known as the Talmud of the Rebbe, but not the Rebbe himself. All right. I mean, they're in the Babish, there is the I've forgotten now the rabbi's name, who's the secretary. Krinsky. Is it Krinsky? I don't know the guys there. I don't know all the. I mean, still get the sort of still hovering around there. But he's always known as the secretary of the Rebbe. It's never going to be the Rebbe. There was a moment or two when they thought maybe he would point to the Rebbe. One of them, I think it was Krinsky. And in the end, no, he's always going to be the Mazkir, the secretary of the Rebbe. And this is the, you know, the Rebbe's Shamas, and the Rebbe's this, and the Rebbe's that. So Yehoshua is always living in the shadow of being the you know, the Rebbe's Talmud. He's Moshe's Talmud. And this is the way he's always treated, and this is the way people always look upon it. It's one of those things, and it's very hard, you know. But you're right, there are certain situations where clearly there is a problem. Yesh baya, right? He doesn't quite do what you expect him to do. This is very, very tough. But he brought him to Eretz Yisrael. You can't really get greater than that. It's very, very interesting. I want to show you just at the bottom here about this distinction between Moshe and Yoshua, and it's on the right hand side at the bottom. After the two paragraphs, it's the last three lines. Va'al shinui katan, this change, be'mase Moshe le'mase Yoshua, between what Moshe did when he addressed the Jewish people, the leadership, and in this case, the masses. And when Yeshua did it, Heiru Chazal, the rabbis actually talk about it, Yerushalmi and Horiot. And what it's a Talmud Yerushalmi, and they say like this, Rabbi Yeshua, last two lines, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi Omer, Rosh, meaning Manigat Tzibur, the head, which is the Manigat Tzibur, the leader, V'Zakein is the Chacham. Then who are you supposed to take first? Zakein Kodem. The Chacham, the one who meaning the one who is wise in Torah, comes before the leadership, meaning the Rosh, meaning the what we would call nowadays the lay leadership, right? What Sir Richard Joel calls the lay Kodesh as opposed to the clay Kodesh, right? He has that very cute phrase. And he says, She'eino Roshim, eino Zokein. I'm not sure what that line is referring to here, but basically what we're saying simply is, normally the Zokein should come first, right? The elder, meaning the one that's representing the wisdom of Torah. There is a fabulous story, and it must have been totally mind-blowing. In London, there's a story goes back 60 years ago. The head of the London based in, Rav Abramsky, very famous rabbi, again, went to Eretz Yisrael, died in 1976. I have a friend in London who used to be mishamish. When Rav Abramsky was getting older and he couldn't get around so much, my friend used to go in and help him sort of every day. And one of the jobs was to make sure that the BBC was tuned in, because he always listened to the BBC World Service, because he wanted to keep up with the news. All right, you know, and he told me that story, and I thought, great, there is one rabbi who actually admits to listening to the radio. It's just a great, great story. Doesn't usually happen like that. And he was a very special man. So the story goes that he was coming out of a simcha, and there was one car waiting to take various people back to where they were living, take them home. And two people came out at the same time. The leader of the United Synagogue organization, the lay leader, all right, who at that time was not an observant man, and Rav Abramsky was coming out at the same time. And they were both getting into the same taxi. So the lay leader thought, you know, Magirli, that I deserve to go first. So he wanted to walk in front of the rabbi and get in. So what did the rabbi do? Rav Abramsky is very uncharacteristic. He got the guy by the collar, pushed him out of the way. And he got into the cab, and the cab went off and left the other guy standing on the street. Everybody standing around was amazed. What's the rabbi doing? And they asked him, they said, Rav Abramsky, what's going on here? So he explained, he said, listen, I didn't do it for my kovod. He says, forget it, this is not my kovod. But he says, kovod atari, he says that in this organization, right, that people need to understand that when somebody represents Torah, they need to be respected. And he did something drastic. He did. I mean, apparently people witnessed it, and they were kind of amazed. But afterwards, when the explanation came out, people understood that sometimes, you know, just to sort of make that point of connection with what the real leadership is about. The spiritual leadership should certainly be given a preference over the how should we say, the more practical leadership, if that's the way to describe it. But that story with Abramsky is quite extraordinary, and it wasn't in his character to do that. So look what it says over here. Just go to the other column, the last three words on the right hand side. Attendance of Imayim. We know that when Moshe called the people, and he said to them, "Attendance of Imayim kulechem." This is now the column on the right hand side, on the left hand side. And in brackets, Roshechem, Shivtechem, Zignechem, Shotrechem. He called the heads of the tribes, your elders, and your officers. All right, that's in Devarim. And Uketiv, and it says, "Ve'yisov Yoshua et kol Ziknei Yisrael." He gathered the elders first. So Moshe gathered the Roshechem, the heads, and Yeshua gathered the Zekenim, the elders. Right? Shechema to Shechem. And Vayikol Zikne Yisrael Roshav, etc. In chapter 24, we just read the verse. Moshe, so he explains, the Gemara says, Moshe Higdim Rashim Lezakeinim. Moshe put the heads of the Jewish people before the Zakeinim. Yeshua Higdim Zakeinim LeRoshim. And Yeshua addressed the Zakeinim, the elders, before the Roshim. The question is why? So he explains, he gives four answers, very interesting, all from the Gemara in this. Number one, Allah. Moshe Al Yedesha Yuha Kol Tamidah. Everybody was the Talmud of Moshe Rabbeinu. Everybody was his student. So what did he do? Higdim Roshim Lizakenim. There's no point in talking about the elders representing Torah because they're all students. They're all really, you know, students of Moshe Rabbeinu. Because Moshe taught everybody. So you have Roshim, you have the heads, and you have the elders. They're all in the same line. They're all in the same boat because they're all students of Moshe. So he explains in the bracket, Gam Roshei HaShvatim Hayu Chachamim. The heads of the tribes were also knowledgeable. V'heyot v'kulam ayu tamidav. Because they were all his students, kibed yotet arashim. Moshe honored the heads because there was no reason to honor the zakenim because everybody was on an equal footing because they're all students of Moshe Rabbeinu. Shegam, shehem gam hachamim yeter chachmei ador. Because everybody here was treated with the same treatment. That's Moshe. Yoshua, it's not true. Yoshua al yedei shelo ayu kol tamidav, but not everybody was his student. Higdim, so at that point, what does Yoshua do? Zakenim l'rashim. That's why he respects the elders before he talks to the heads of the tribes. Alav yichabed kodem echachmei ador. It's upon him to honor those who are the wise men of the generation, the Talmidei Chachamim, shayu Talmidei Moshe Rabba, who were the students of Moshe Rabbeinu. So for Yoshua, it was a different prospect. Not that everybody was his student, so he could honor whoever, you know, he would then go to the heads before the elders. No. For him, not everybody was his student. The elders were always going to be there, would always demand, or would always have to be given a higher level of attention, of respect. And those are the ones that he honored first. So Yoshua honored the Zakenim, the elders, whereas Moshe could honor. He went back to the Roshim, he went back to the heads of the tribes, because in essence, everybody was his student, everybody was on an equal footing. That's suggestion number one. Suggestion number two is also interesting, but Moshe al shalot sarech lahem, kibush aris. Moshe did not need the elders or the heads of the tribes to conquer the land. He didn't conquer the land, he was outside Israel. So therefore, Higdim Roshim Lizakenim. Therefore, when he addresses the Jewish people, he puts the Roshim. He puts those who are the heads of the tribes first. But Yoshua, we know with Yoshua, Al Yedeshet Sarech Lehem Lizakenim. He needed the Zakenim, because every so often, he calls the Zakenim, and he has discussions with them, how to go about, what to do, etc., etc. They were advising him. So therefore, B'kibush Ha'aretz, in conquering the land, Higdim Zakenim the Roshim, so he gave them more respect. Because they had helped him so much more than the heads of the tribes, therefore he wanted to show respect. That's why he calls them first. He calls the Zakenim first. Number three, interesting also. Moshe al yedei shelo nit yaga b'talmud Torah m'zakenim. Moshe did not necessarily tire himself out with the Zakenim, studying with them. In other words, everybody learned from him. He wasn't working hard to study with those who were the elders of the generation. He studied with everybody. So Higdim Roshim Lizakenim, therefore he put the heads of the tribes first. But Yoshua, Alidesh Nityaga B'Talmud Torah M'Zakenim, Yoshua had to study so much more, with such more effort with the Zakenim, because they were older than him. They were going back to the days of Moshe Rabbeinu more than he was. Then Higdim Zakenim the Roshim. That's why he respected the elders more than the heads, because the elders represented this continuation of Torah right back to the early days. And then finally, Rabbi Shua Desichli Mishem Rabbi Levi, another interpretation, Moshe Ali Deshit Safa Baruch Kodesh. This is so interesting. Moshe could see in the future. He could see with Ruach HaKodesh, with prophecy. Sha'asidim Yisrael Istaker Limaseh Biad Malchiyot. He knew that eventually the Jewish people would be given over to the nations. They would go into exile. V'rasheim omdim al gabeim. And they would be led by the heads of the nation, the heads of the tribes. They would be the ones taking them into exile. So higdim roshim lizakenim. So he gave more respect to them, because in the end, the heads of the tribes are going to have to bear the brunt of Golus, of exile. Whereas the Zakenim are not going to be leading the people out. So therefore, Moshe wanted to show, even at this early stage, when obviously we're coming into Israel, we're not talking about leaving Israel, but eventually the heads of the tribes will be the ones who will be most responsible for the Jewish people in Golus, in exile. So he started respecting them right at the beginning. Yeshua did not have that particular prophecy. Obviously Moshe may have kept it to himself. He didn't tell Yeshua. And as such, Yeshua honors the Zakenim. Very interesting. So Yeshua is clearly, again, he's struggling to get the Zakenim, the elders, those who represent the wisdom, the wisdom of Torah, those leaders, he's struggling to get them to respect him. It sort of reminds me of the challenge of being a chief rabbi of a country. Right? In England, they talk about the biggest problem the chief rabbi had, Rabbi Sacks, for instance, is to convince the Beth Din, the London Beth Din, which has a reputation right around the world, that, you know, he can be sort of, he can lead them. All right, because technically he's Rosh Bet Din, he's the head of the Bet Din. One of the things he probably didn't achieve and may have regretted that, you know, he just never convinced them. And that's been part of a problem of finding the successor. They were always looking for someone who can maybe not necessarily outshine the Bet Din, but can certainly relate to the Bet Din. But Jonathan Sacks is coming from a very different world to the rabbis on the Bet Din, so it's a very, very different situation.
And the heads of the tribes lost Moravah. And the theory is that they, you know, they want to go to Israel because they want to maintain their stature and so forth.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, Yeshua didn't forget that the heads of the tribes, they have their own agenda, and the Canaan don't.
And there's a Canaan don't. Very good.
Maybe that's another reason he said, you know what, even though they're the top of the tribes, doesn't mean that they're the ones I want to rely on.
And that again may have been part of the reason why maybe there was a kind of distance as well between, you know, the heads and him. It's very, very interesting. And again, Mitzvah Shem, what we'll see, we're coming to time. So what we'll see, Mitzvah Shem, next week, these pages I'm going to collect in because we're going to look at the other side next week, which again deals with this very fundamental question of why the speech is repeated twice. And also, not only the repetition, but if you look at chapter 24, during the week, you'll see that there is a very different approach. A very, very different approach of Yeshua when he's talking to Amcha, when he's talking to the Jewish people, as opposed to when he is talking to the leadership. And that, again, is very, very unusual and sort of gives us something to think about at the end of the Sefer. What I also want to deal with next week, Mitzvah Hashem, is just to talk, thank you, just to deal a little bit with the style of leadership. In the end of the day, how do we define Yeshua's leadership? We'll talk about that because there's a lot to say as a kind of finishing touch to the whole Sefer, and I hope people will be able to make it. We're not davening Mara. Eight people. Is Larry going to Grayson? He's not going to make it. All right, so I think then we'll have to adjourn. So Mitzvah Shem, next week we'll be finishing. See him hopefully next Monday night, just before Yom Tov. And then we'll finish Rus. Okay, well, we'll finish the Sefer, please God, next week. Thank you, everybody.